Now, because I have my granddaughter here, I've been told to make the lesson short. With that kind of imperial summons, I have to do that. Exodus chapter 7. We won't get through the whole passage because this, in the middle of the chapter, we start the plagues. So we're going to do the prelude today. Exodus chapter 7. One of the commentaries that I consulted is written by Hebrew scholars, and they have Hebrew over the first half of the page for me to struggle with as I work through, because remember, there's nothing, very few words in Hebrew that translate into English. Cinnamon and camel are about the only two I can think of. So I'm struggling through the passage, but they have some comments down at the bottom. And one of the rabbis made the following statement, and it was so good, I had to write it down. He said, the real sign of an advanced civilization is not its literature, nor its art, or architecture, or economy, or military strength, or form of government. The real sign of an advanced civilization is its vision of God. Where there is no vision of God, people worship animals and inanimate objects, leading to inhuman acts and preoccupation with death and immorality. Let me give you a brief example of that. If you turn briefly to Hosea chapter 4, we won't look at the whole chapter, I'm just wanting to illustrate a point. Hosea chapter 4. Now, if you know anything about the book of Hosea, you know that the first three chapters tell of Hosea's relationship to Gomer, who acts like a prostitute and has three children that have significant names. But in chapter 4, we find that there is a number of lawsuits. Well, that's the technical term for it, that God has with Israel. He takes them to court, and that's what this whole thing is. It's called in Hebrew a riv, R-I-B in English, but there's two baits and abets in Hebrew. One is hard and one soft, and so you would pronounce it as riv. The B would be like a V. In chapter 4, starting verse 1, hear the word of the Lord. That's the problem. They haven't been hearing the word of the Lord. As I've said before, the Hebrew word shema, for translated hear, means more than mere listening. It means to obey. We saw this same idea in the book of James. That when it says swift to hear, he's not talking about mere listening, but having an active faith. Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel. So he has defined his audience. Hosea chapter 4, verse 1. If you're having trouble finding Hosea, just go take Matthew and turn left. And if you reach Daniel, you've gone too far. Hosea. Now that you found the right street, chapter 4, I'll give you the right address, verse 2, verse 1. Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel. Now he gives a reason for this lawsuit, this controversy. He says, for the Lord has a controversy, and there's our Hebrew word, riv. He has a lawsuit. He has a complaint. And this goes back, as often in the Old Testament we see this, it goes back to the covenant that God established with Israel, part of which is Leviticus chapter 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28 through 30 being the relevant sections of the covenant. Now, the book of Deuteronomy itself is one huge covenant. It's in a covenant form, what's called a suzerain-vassal treaty form. Suzerain, referring to the sovereign or the stronger of the two powers in this alliance, and a vassal, the slave. So you have a strong country, say like Babylon, making a covenant with Israel, a weaker, and says basically, okay, here's what I require of you. I require this, 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 and this. If you do this, 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 and this, I will bless you with this, 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 and this. However, if you disobey this covenant in this, 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 and this, then I will bring these curses on you, this, 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 and this. And that is what Deuteronomy is about. Leviticus 26 lists the curses in a kind of a series. First this, then this, then this, then this. And you go down these steps of discipline, and about the fourth one is that the nation would be invaded, which, of course, the book of Daniel begins in that fourth step. The fifth step is deportation. Now, Hosea is going to talk about the 10 northern tribes, and they are in deep trouble. And in 722, the Assyrians are going to come down, and they're going to remove the 10 tribes, the lost tribes. You hear about that. They tear up the country, the 10 northern tribes, because of their idolatry. Remember, you have Rehoboam. He's this young buck who comes to the throne as the son of Solomon. And the counselors come around him, his advisors, and say, oh, the taxes are too high. Solomon raised these high taxes because he wanted to build this temple, and the people are groaning under too much taxes. Ever? Does that sound like anything you might have heard recently? Too many taxes. Well, what do you suggest? Well, Rehoboam's advisors say, we suggest that you reduce the taxes. That'll make people love you, and they'll think kindly of you. But Rehoboam's an idiot. Idiots often become kings and presidents of a country. I am convinced that one of the ways in which God punishes a country is he gives them poor leadership. Would you agree with me that the current flock of leaders that we have in this country is a sign of God's judgment on our people? I think so. Yeah, there aren't any Washingtons or Lincolns around anymore. Someone said these brilliant men of the founding fathers built a country of laws so that the idiots that follow them could operate. That's true. Rehoboam says, nah, man, if I reduce the taxes, I look like I'm a weak leader. I'm strong. In fact, my little finger, some think that's a euphemism for something else, but that my little finger is stronger than Solomon's hand. So we're going to take care of those taxes. We're going to increase them. Well, that doesn't go over very well. So the leader of the opposition is a man named Jeroboam. Jeroboam said, we're out of here. So he becomes the leader for the 10 northern tribes, and they separate themselves. They call themselves Israel, the 10 northern tribes, and Judah and Benjamin in the south. So there is this kind of civil war. But Rehoboam understands we got a problem here. We may be a separate nation, but three times every year, every faithful Jew has to do what? Go to Jerusalem. They cross the border. They go down to Judah. They go to Jerusalem. Who knows what will happen when they get down there? They may be persuaded to stay down there. They may be decided that, hey, it's better down here in the south than it is in the north, and we need to go back up and have revolution up in the north and get us reunited with the south. He doesn't like it. So Jeroboam decides we're going to have two places where you can go worship. One is in Dan, in the far, and another one I can't is in Ephraim. So Dan is down here at the south, just before you cross the border. And the one up north. Now, does that sound like convenience for you? You don't have to walk all the way to Jerusalem to go to the temple to offer your sacrifices. We'll offer these convenient places where you won't have to leave the country and you can go to the nearest branch. By the way, studies have shown one of the leading reasons why people choose a church is its location, its nearness to their house. Further, if it's on the way they drive to work, they're familiar with that path, they'll do that too. But that's human nature. So they have these two places of worship. And all of a sudden, the moral decay begins to set in the 10 northern tribes. As you read the book of 1 and 2 Kings, you begin to see that whenever a king in the 10 northern tribes is mentioned, he's always mentioned as having done evil in the sight of the Lord. There is not a single good king in the 10 northern tribes. In the south, it's a mixed bag. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. And if you read 1 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, you'll begin to see this pattern. Now, Hosea is a prophet to the northern country. He is a prophet up there in the 10 tribes. And the significance of his relationship with Gomer is the same as symbolizes the 10 northern tribes' relationship to God. He is faithful to them, but they are unfaithful to him. So after he finishes the first three chapters of the relationship of Gomer, who turns out, his wife turns out to be a prostitute, and it ends happily, they get back together. But here starts a series of lawsuits, four of them, all the way to the end of the book. And here's the first one. So he says, "Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel." He's talking to the 10 northern tribes. Why? "For the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land." He's taking them to court, so to speak. They have violated this covenant and by their worship and so forth. So he says they have violated it. Now he states more specifically their problem. There is, one, no faithfulness. Number two, or steadfast love, or number three, knowledge of God in the land. Now, Hosea is going to take up these three complaints, okay? There's going to be no faithfulness, steadfast love. Steadfast love is covenant loyalty. That's what that is, covenant loyalty, and knowledge of God. But now he's going to take them in reverse order. Now, you remember the literary device that I called a chiasm, which is a V that sideways. You have what here? You have first faithfulness, loyal love, no knowledge of God. Then, in the exact opposite order, he's going to take up these complaints. No knowledge of God, lack of steadfast faith, covenant loyalty, no faith. So it's going to be this kind of pattern. It's called a chiasm. Now, when you have a chiasm like this, the key point is right here where the V, where the two lines meet. So he starts off with the number one complaint. Even though it's listed last in those three there, that's the first one he picks up. There is no knowledge of God in the land. Now, in verse 2, there is a cause and effect relationship. There is swearing, lying, murder, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds. There's no moral boundaries, no covenants that are kept, no contracts that are honored. And bloodshed follows bloodshed. The place is getting increasingly more violent. Now, you remember the quotation I read for the rabbi, that a true sign of an advanced civilization is its vision of God, not its government, not its economy, not its military, not its art, literature, architecture, none of that. There is no knowledge of God. They do not know, they do not understand, they do not acknowledge, they do not obey the covenant that God has kept with them. And included in that covenant is the Ten Commandments. So because there is no knowledge of God, I want you to see this. This confirms what the rabbi was saying. Notice there's a cause and effect. Because there is no knowledge of God, do you see the social manifestations of that? There it is, right in verse 3. There is swearing. Man, there's no limit anything. And I won't repeat the words, but you know what they are. You hear them every day. Some are obscene, dealing with sex. Some are scatological, dealing with human excrement. Some are profane, dealing with the use of religious words in a non-religious context. There is a devaluation of the language. Then there's lying. Well, why not? You can put a picture of your favorite politician right here. But not just them. Industries. The cigarette industry knew for years the harmful effect of smoking. They had done their own private tests. But it stopped business. Lying. Murder. Man, that's increasing. Stealing. Let's put the word San Francisco there. Where I saw a YouTube video of people going into CVS with a pillow blanket, just scooping things off the shelf. If it's under $900, no problem. And committing adultery. Notice, do you see the effects of no knowledge of God? And that's why I think we, America today, is showing all the signs of a God-starved, God-ignorant community. I am not surprised at the nation falling to pieces. Well, look at verse 3. Not only does this disobedience have an effect on humanity, It affects creation. Therefore, the land mourns, and all who dwell in it languish, and also the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heaven, and even the fish of the sea are taken away. Now, this is partly due to their disobedience to the covenant. Because when you read the covenant, especially Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 through 30, you see that if they are faithful to God, he's going to let their crops flourish. They're going to have great health. They're going to have financial prosperity. Everything's going to go great. But Israel, the 10 northern tribes, have no knowledge of God. So already the curses of the covenant are starting to take effect. Now, what's sad, and you see this also in the book of Haggai, the people of God see the effect of their sin, but they don't stop sinning. They don't say, I'm getting it. There's a connection here of cause and effect. I guess I shouldn't be doing this because this is the result of my disobedience. They don't see it. All of us, I think, are blind. If not for God's grace, all of us would see nothing. We would go through life as unseeing, almost animals, not having learned anything. It's a shame to waste your pain. But that's what happens. Now, not only that, but you see, the religious people aren't helping any. The religious people are, and we'll see this Wednesday night, where Paul says we are not hucksters. We don't treat the word of God as a commodity to be sold. It's not a business. But look at verse 4. Let no one contend, let none accuse, for with you is my contention, O priest. Now he goes down from the nation down to the religious leaders. They are the people that should know better. They are the people that should be leading the counter-revolution that's going on in the land. But they're not. You shall stumble by day. The prophet also shall stumble with you by night. I will destroy your mother. And then we have verse 6, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. And whose fault is that? Partly the people, but partly the priest and the religious organization who decided that we're going to operate the church like we would a market. We're going to be market savvy. We're going to learn how to market the church. We're going to do surveys to find out what the people want from a church, and then we're going to deliver it for them. I know of churches that have adopted that model. They actually did take surveys of the community and found out what the people wanted in the church, and then they built a church to meet the people's desires. Now, that is success in business. A successful business finds a need and then tries to fill it. Now, every person has a spiritual need, but instead of doing that, we're going to ask the unbeliever, what is it you want? Not ask God, what does he want in his church? We're going to take our business experience and bring it into the church, and we're going to say, what do the people want? And we're going to give the people what they want. Now, it's true, the people always vote, sometimes with their feet. They don't like what's going on, or they've got their own petty quarrel with something, or just all sorts of reasons. But that's what happens. But he says, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. They don't know the word. They don't obey the word. Now, look at the result here. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will reject you from being a priest to me. Now, the nation was to be a priest. By the way, This is often misunderstood. I've been in churches where this was misunderstood. We talk about the believer priest, and we say that means that you answer directly to God. Well, that's part of what a priest does, but a priest is an intercessor. A priest is a go-between. He would come and take the sacrifice of the supplicant, and then he would take it before God. And it is your privilege as a believer priest to take the gospel to other people and to bring their needs before the Lord in prayer. Ruth Ann and I had an example of this last night, didn't we, Ruth Ann? We're about ready to go to bed, and the doorbell rings. Well, I have to turn the light on the porch because I don't want to be too surprised. Open the door, and it's the next door neighbor. Can I come in? Sure. I want to talk. Well, you took one look at her, and you could tell she is not physically well. She is literally skin and bones. Come on in. I've got lung cancer, and I know you are Christian, and I want you to pray for me. We'll be happy to do that. Raised in a Southern Baptist church, I think it's fair to say she has not been living for the Lord, but here she is. And it's our privilege as believer priests to say, you please sit down. What can we do? How can we help you? You want our prayers? You got them. Let's get together and we'll pray. And we'll continue to pray with you and for you. That's what a priest does. And Ruth Ann and I thought later how flattered we were that she knew that when she had a need, that we would be her intercessor. Now, I wish that for all of you. Okay. Well, why has the nation been rejected? Since you have forgotten the law of your God, I will forget your children. Now, this doesn't mean that God has a blank in his memory. What it means is he's going to no longer treat them with favor. They're going to be under divine discipline. Look at verse 9, drop down to verse 9. And it shall be like people, like priest. What's the problem? The religious organization has not stood firm for biblical truth. They have capitulated to the desires of the people. I will punish them for their ways and repay them for their deeds. And how does he do it? Verse 17. Ephraim is joined to idols. Leave him alone. Ephraim was the largest of the 10 northern tribes. Ephraim is often used as representative of the entire tribe. So he could be referring to just Ephraim of the 10 tribes, or by this he could be referring to the whole nation, since Ephraim is often used to represent the whole nation, being the largest of the tribes. How does God punish sin? How does God punish sin? With more sin. How does God punish the northern tribes? Okay, gentlemen, you don't want me? You're on your own. And God walks away. And what happens in 722? You have Esarhaddon, Sennacherib, Tiglath-Pileser, and Sargon II coming down and invading, and that's the end of the 10 northern tribes. So this rabbi that says the vision of God is the key to the greatness of a society is true. And we're going to see, as we've been going through Exodus, that Pharaoh believes he is God. And he has said already, who is this God that you worship, Moses, that I, who am also a God, should obey him? So all of this that's going to happen next, all of the plagues, are going to give 10 reasons why Pharaoh and Egypt should believe Yahweh to be the true God. They have a false view of God. And yes, Egypt right at this point is the superpower of the ancient East. And when we talk about Egypt, remember, we're not talking about Egypt as you currently see it on the map. Egypt back then was a 20-mile strip of land going right down the Nile. Because the river Nile would overflow its banks every year, leave fertile soil on what is otherwise a desert place. And that's where they had all their crops. And they became the breadbasket for the ancient world. That's where their power came. And that's why Rome wanted to have Egypt and the Mediterranean free of pirates so that that bread line could feed Rome. So we're going to be getting into this, and here comes a battle of the gods. Egypt had their greatness, economy, and so forth, but it's now going to take a huge hit. And it will never really properly recover. They're going to be trying to bring it back, but it won't. Remember, when Moses shows up, the pyramids have already been built before Moses was born. Built before the children of Israel went down there. So the greatness of Egypt is now going to start going into eclipse. And it'll always be fertile, and it'll always be kind of the breadbasket of the ancient world, but it will never be the superpower that it is after this whole thing. And so, again, Pharaoh's and the people's belief in these false gods and each of the plagues targets one of these false gods are all going to be seen as inferior to the true God. So the rabbi is right. The real sign of an advanced civilization is not its literature, art, architecture, economy, military strength, or form of government, but its vision of God. Where there is no vision of God, people worship animals and inanimate objects, just like in Egypt, leading to inhuman acts, bondage, and occupation with death, the pyramids, and immorality. The Egyptians did not believe lying and cheating and stealing were wrong. They had a different set of what was immoral for them. They had nothing similar to the Ten Commandments. Well, my time is up. And I guess we'll have to wait to next week to get into Exodus chapter 7. But I thought this statement by this rabbi was profound, and I immediately thought of Hosea chapter 6 and the destruction. And by the way, if you want a title for 1 and 2 Kings, may I recommend the book title that William L. Shire used for his history of Nazi Germany, or go back to Edward Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Davidic Kingdom. That is 1 and 2 Kings. Why? Because Solomon had a divided heart, and the nations after him, the two nations, went into apostasy, forsaking God. They lost their vision of God and had no knowledge of him. Are there any questions before I close? Thank you for listening, and thank you for letting me go on this huge rabbit trail. Father, we need you. We need to know you. We need to see you. Because it's hard to follow someone you cannot see. Guide our steps. Teach us your law and your way, that walking in them, we may be assured of a good ending. This we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.